This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Write On, showcasing the work and lives of Otago and Southland writers. Tune in for news and interviews with your local writers on the second Wednesday of every month from noon till 1 and repeated the following Sunday at 1 p.m. Kindly sponsored by the great team at the University Bookshop. What do you want to be when you grow up? They say you are what you read, and the University Bookshop can help you be whoever you want to be. Do you want to be an athlete? Then sit down with an inspiring sports biography. Do you fancy yourself as a detective? We have a grisly lineup of murder mysteries waiting just for you. Do you aspire to be the world's greatest chef? We have cookbooks to tantalise your taste buds. Do you want to celebrate your inner child? Play up in our fabulous children's room. The University Bookshop, helping you decide what you want to be when you grow up. Good afternoon and welcome. You're listening to Otago Access Radio and Write On with Vanda Simon, which is the show of the Otago Southland branch of the New Zealand Society of Authors, and it's sponsored by that great team at the University Bookshop. Join us for the next hour as we delve into that wonderful world of books. Now, earlier on in the week, I got to catch up with Dunedin writer, editor and photographer Paul Sorrell. Here is my chat with him. Paul Sorrell is a writer, editor and wildlife photographer who I've had the pleasure of chatting with on Write On a number of times with his publications over the years. And today we get to talk about his most recent publication, Getting Closer, Rediscovering Nature Through Bird Photography. Paul, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Vanda. It's good to be here.
Now, previously when we've talked about your publications, Trail, Riding the Otago Central Rail Trail, Fleur's Place and Peninsula, these books have been collaborations with Graham Warman as a photographer and your text and pictures. Now, Getting Closer is entirely you as a writer and a photographer. So, you know, we often talked about you as a writer. Can you fill me in on your background then as a photographer?
Well, I guess for about 20 years, I've been interested in photography. I've always also been interested in wildlife, so that I used to read wildlife magazines, BBC Wildlife Magazine and its earlier incarnations, and I got really sort of excited about the way people were taking wonderful photographs of the natural world. So writing is something I've done for a long time. Photography, I've done something for, a lesser amount of time, but bringing them together, I'm really excited about the fact that you can bring words and images together and they'll play off against each other. And that's to some extent what I've tried to do in the book and what I'm trying to do more and more in the writing and projects that I'm doing now.
So, was it quite a different proposition writing a book when you weren't collaborating with someone else, when it was all your work that was going into it?
Well, yes, it was. The editor of Exile Publishing, who's a friend of mine, suggested I do the book. I always seem to need a prompt if I'm going to do anything big. And I don't often say no. So it was a big thing for me to do. To be fair, with the Peninsula book, I had supplied some of the wildlife photography there and Graham did the rest. So I'd already got a little bit of a foothold in the illustration business. But I'd taken a lot of photos over the years. It was just a question of sorting them out. I wanted to illustrate all the points I was making as best I could. This is back in 2021, and now, of course, I've got a whole lot more photos of a whole lot more birds. And I wish I was doing the book now and I'd have a wider spread. But look, it was exciting. I really just wanted to share my enthusiasm about wildlife photography and encourage other people to take it up. And, it's been a great journey. I get such a lot out of wildlife photography. Just getting outdoors is so relaxing, good for your health, good for your mental health too, to get out in wild spaces. And then there's the creative side. You don't know what you're going to encounter. you may have been to the place before, but always there's something different happening. And there's always the possibility of coming home with some really good stuff, even if you get just one or two shots in a whole session, a whole day out, that you're really pleased with. That makes the whole thing worthwhile.
And I think this is what one of the things that makes this book perhaps slightly different to other books about photography is some of your messaging that comes through, in that it's not just about the taking of the photographs. Now, tell us about that wanting to get the message about the whole experience of photography.
Well, at one end, you know, the sort of wide end of things, we all know that we're living in a time of ecological crisis with biodiversity on the decline, climate change, and this can create a lot of anxiety, any feelings of guilt, especially among young people. And a lot of people feel paralyzed by the situation. But if you're able to do something, however small, something that makes a difference, something that's tied into the natural world, like taking wildlife shots, it's not only satisfying for you, but you can offer, as I do, photographs to organizations like Orokinui. This year's calendar has got 4 or 5 pictures of mine in, for example. You know, other environmental organizations, you can actually begin to make a tiny little bit of difference. And if you add up what your contribution with all the other photographers and people doing their own thing, you know, in the natural world to help to improve the situation, then it can add up to something quite big. So that's at the large end of the scale. And then I think just the creative, the joy that you feel. Sometimes when I go to a place where I know that there are birds, that I've been there before, it's so relaxing. You're working with perhaps a particular bird that it sounds a bit weird that you've got to know. And they come out and greet you, and they sit there and they almost consent to be photographed. And you want to say, can you just turn your head to the left a little? and you feel that you feel relaxed. Time slows down. You get in the zone, as they say. And it's like a meditative experience. It really is. At its best, wildlife photography can be a meditative thing. And that's wonderful, and that was kind of unexpected for me. But so I really seek those experiences. It's so relaxing and creative at the same time, and you're in nature. So really it couldn't get much better.
So you see your photography as a way of like reconnecting with nature, because, you know, basically our modern lives, we can be so disconnected, can't we?
Absolutely. And, you know, I'm on social media and I realize I spend too much time posting and liking and checking on the progress of my latest photo. And to be fair, you know, I want to look at everybody else's photos. And honestly, I fall into that trap just as much as anybody does. But it's so good to get out there. The rhythms. The natural rhythms of nature, we're, I think, largely disconnected with, because when it's raining or stormy, we can go inside our warm homes and escape. But the wildlife doesn't have that, you know, privilege. So I've got to know about, you know, the winds and the tides, you know, when to shoot at high tide, low tide, if there's a nor'easterly wind blowing, you know that that's going to be good if you want to get pictures of the albatrosses at Tairo ahead, because it's going to they're going to be up in the air, and their approach to their landing areas is going to be more photographable in that sort of wind. So you learn these tricks, you learn a lot of things about the natural world that you just completely overlooked before. The seasons, what's happening at any one point. I mean, for example, the other day I went out to Orokinui and the Caprosma bushes were full of berries. and the birds were feeding on the berries. And so you've got wonderful opportunity to get shots of birds feeding with a big plump berry in their beak, because you're always looking for something different. You know, it gets boring after a while just to have the bird on the twig. You want the bird doing something. So now I'm, you know, intensely interested in what's happening in the plant world as well as the bird world. You know, when do they build their nests? When are they feeding on what kind of fruit? And all of that kind of thing, which before I didn't take much interest in, now is of great interest to me as a photographer. And I think the more, I mean, just to make the general point, that the more you get to know the bird's behavior, the places they go, the more knowledge you have, then the more ready you will be to take great shots when the opportunity occurs. And I've got this idea of your local patch. Well, it's not my idea. It's a general sort of thing amongst photographers, wildlife photographers. You go back and back and back to the same patch, which in my case is Orokanui, in different seasons, in different weathers, in different lights, different times of year. And there's always something happening. The birds might change, or they will be changing their behavior. But you really get to know the place inside out, and then you can begin to take really considered photographs. But you don't have to go a long way. You can do it in your own backyard. And some of the best shots I've taken have been through my bedroom window, because I've got a little setup. In my book, I talk about making a setup in your backyard. So all you need is a natural-looking branch that you can rig up if you don't have a handy tree, and perhaps a sugar water feeder if you want to attract the honey eaters, the tuis and the bellbirds and the silver eyes. And then you put the feeder just beside the branch. You don't photograph them on the feeder, but they'll come and land on the branch, and that's when you snap them, and they'll go onto the feeder. And sometimes you can get really great action shots. The silver eyes are all crowding up and squawking and getting excited, fighting each other. So that's a very simple way of creating what I like to call a sort of outdoor studio, where you've got a bit of control of the elements. You can situate it where the light is good, for example, where the background is good. The background is blurred out so that the birds pop into focus. And look, it's great too if you're housebound, if you're, you know, you're elderly and you don't get out much, this is something you can do from home. You can take great wildlife photos from home without even going outside. You know, I've sat in an easy chair with a cup of tea and set up my tripod with my lens sticking out the window if I'm feeling like that, or, yeah.
And I suppose on the other end of the age scale, it's a great way, you know, round home to encourage children to experiment with photography.
It is as well. So it starts at home in your own garden, or whatever kind of garden you've got. There will be possibilities.
You said earlier about social media and things like that. And, you know, this book was probably going to benefit amateur and more seasoned photographers with cameras. But phones nowadays have such amazing cameras on them. How can your phone photographer benefit from, you know, from this book and from getting out there and doing wildlife photography on your phone?
It's difficult with wildlife on your cell phone. It would be – the trouble is getting close enough to actually register the bird on your cell phone that's more than a dot. It's good for landscape photography. It's wonderful for that, cell phones. Or perhaps bigger animals if you can get fairly close to a sea lion. But even then you might have to get a little bit closer than you really should. It's possible. One style of wildlife photography is showing the bird or animal in its environment. So the mobile phone photography could be okay for that, where you've got mostly the environment and the subject is a little bit smaller. But I say to people, if you're interested in photographing small birds, you really have to have at least 300 millimeters in your lens, 300 millimeter lens. I've got a 400. And that's about right. I just found, you know, field techniques for getting closer to birds. So if my lens isn't long enough, I just try to work myself a little bit closer. And there are, I discuss those techniques in the book. So, when I first started out, I wanted to fill the frame of the bird because I thought it was almost miraculous that you could do that. But now I'm standing back a bit, getting more of the environment in, wanting to get a little bit more of the bird setting in the picture. So you don't have to get especially close. But one thing that is really revolutionizing my photography now is cameras are mirrorless. There's a whole, you may have heard, there's been a switch from the SLRs to the mirrorless camera. So they're silent, the shutters are silent. And most important of all, you've got eye tracking. So you can follow a bird around in flight or as it hops about. And this is great. You're not losing a few vital seconds trying to focus on the eye because it does it for you. And that's the part of the bird that always ought to be sharp, the eye and the head, or at least the eye, because the eye is what speaks to us. And that's why I always try to get to eye level. I can. Might mean lying on the ground if the bird's sitting on the ground. Because that creates that kind of intimacy in the gaze between you, the viewer, and the animal that's looking out at you. And people love those shots more than any other because it speaks to them.
Mm. And it's definitely connecting with nature when you're lying on the ground.
When I was younger, I used to crawl hundreds of yards over sand, you know, making my way towards a flock of roosting birds. But I tend not to do so much of that now. Occasionally I'll get down in the grass and to be on the eye level with a bird that's sitting down there. So, yes, it does keep you fit.
Now, you mentioned earlier that Orokanui is a place that you go to all the time. We had previously talking about some of the special relationships you've built up with birds. You know, tell us some of the stories of your Orokanui birds.
Well, I always love photographing the tomtits. They're friendly birds. They're not quite as friendly as the robins, but if you're quiet and careful around them, they will come round and not be bothered by you. So in the early part of the year, I found a little female tomtit, just a fledgling, and I watched her play. It gave me such pleasure. She splayed her legs out, and one was sitting on a piece of lichen and another on a leaf, and she rocked to and fro, clearly playing and enjoying playing. And then from then on, every time I visited, she was there in the same clearing, going to the same perches. And so I've got a series of photographs of her from when she was a fledgling through growing up. Now she's in full adult plumage and she's still coming back. We kind of greet each other. She has a brother too who's much shyer, although he started to come out now. And he's now in full plumage. So I've followed and photographed these two birds and got a whole series of pretty nice pictures. So this is the sort of project you can do when you get to know a place really well. There's all kinds of projects you can do. And I've, in this one spot, I've photographed a lot of other birds as well. So I've got the other wildlife that surrounds this pair of tomtits. So grey warblers, robins, there were even cuckoos in this little place. In the summer. So it's building up a picture, creating a portrait of an area over time. and it can be very satisfying.
I look forward to seeing that story in pictures.
Well, yes, I'm hoping to publish that somewhere as a picture story. I'd like it to be light on the words and heavy on the images. So I'm exploring options for that.
Yeah, Orica Nui is clearly a favourite for you. What other places around Otago, you know, locally are great spots where people can go and experience, you know, wildlife or birds that are photographable?
One place I go quite often is Hawkesbury Lagoon, Waikawhiti. And in the lagoon, there are wading birds like stilts. We've got spoonbills at the moment. There's a white heron there that comes and goes. I went there the other day and the water level was really too high for the wading birds. So I photographed some fantails that were flitting about in the last rays of the day, last rays of the sun, and got some nice shots and really rich lighting. So that's a good place to go. Aramoana, I've been there quite often. You go down the mole and there's a colony of terns and gulls. There's always a few seals lying around. You might even see some penguins there. You never know what you go to see. And then on the beach at Aramoana, there are sea lions that come up. Black oyster catchers. Again, you can't be sure what you're going to see. So those are two places that are well worth anybody's time who's keen on photographing the wildlife.
I think that's one of the wonderful things about living where we do is we're so close to nature.
We are. And then, of course, the peninsula is famous, world famous, really, for the wildlife. It makes us, you know, New Zealand's wildlife capital. Sadly, the yellow-eyed penguins, which used to be such stars, are in decline. It's not so easy to find them now. So my best shots of them are from quite a few years ago. So let's hope that things turn around for them.
Mm-hmm. So if you're going to, you know, summarise, what is the thing you do find most rewarding about your photography?
Well, apart from the personal satisfaction and I think growth that it gives you, I've made connections with quite a few other wildlife photographers, both locally here in Dunedin and throughout New Zealand. And that's mostly been on Instagram, which I think is, for me, is the most useful of the social media sites, where you can become part of a community, a specialized community, whatever it is that you're doing and interests you. So just the other day, I went out with a couple of photographers whom I'd met that way, and we went to Tomahawk Lagoon, actually, which is another good place to go. And so I'm building relationships both online and in real life with other people who share the same passion, and that's great.
So do you have any more projects in mind coming up, other than, you know, the lovely little one with your tomtits? Or are you having to have someone prod you again to go into a big project?
It may be that I need a prod. I'm pretty excited with the tomtit project at the moment. Maybe Hawkesbury Lagoon, there's such a lot going on there. You never know what's going to happen. The spoonbills, I got some really great spoonbill shots one time I was there. But, you know, for every time you get great shots like that, you may go back half a dozen times and nothing's happening. So, that could be a focus of a project. I'm not settled on that. I'm just going with the tomtits at the moment and thinking about that and how they're part of the wider scene where they live. It's making the connections that you realise is important, because birds just aren't out there just on their own. There's a whole network of plants and food plants and insects, insect life, other birds, other animals that determine how they're going to get on and whether they'll thrive or not. So, I mean, even at Orokinui, it's a predator-proof sanctuary. And yet, quite often, I've seen little piles of feathers on the ground, which means that a bird has been struck down by a ruru, moorpork, or a falcon, both of which are present in the sanctuary. So we have the aerial predators, the native ones, and they're all part of the mix, and we just accept that. But I mean, I was watching a nest that tomtips were building, and it was going fine. And then one day, underneath the nest was a pile of feathers, and I think it was the female who'd been taken, and that nest failed. But now this is the very same clearing where the young tomtits are active. So life goes on.
That's great. Well, look, thank you so much, Paul, for coming on and talking about your book, Getting Close to Rediscovering Nature Through Bird Photography, but also, you know, just generally speaking of that great benefit of getting out there in nature and taking some pictures and going back. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thanks so much, Vanda. It's been great.
So that was Paul Sorrell talking about getting closer, rediscovering nature through bird photography. Now, Paul is involved in a number of events at the Wild Dunedin New Zealand Festival of Nature that is on this week and next, so keep an eye out on the program. Well, we're going to take a short music break. I'll be back soon.
Into the deep blue sky. When I think of home, I sadly sigh. Oh, I can see you there with loving tears in your eyes. As we fondly said our last goodbye. Stay. I promise to be true and to love only you. Blue smoke goes drifting by into the deep blue skies. My memories of home will never die.
What do you want to be when you grow up? They say you are what you read, and the University Bookshop can help you be whoever you want to be. Do you want to be an athlete? Then sit down with an inspiring sports biography. Do you fancy yourself as a detective? We have a grisly lineup of murder mysteries waiting just for you. Do you aspire to be the world's greatest chef? We have cookbooks to tantalize your taste buds. Whether you want to celebrate your inner child, play up in our fabulous children's room, the University Bookshop, helping you decide what you want to be when you grow up.
Welcome back. You're listening to Otago Access Radio and Write On with Vanda Simon, which is the show of the Otago Southland branch of the New Zealand Society of Authors, and it's sponsored by the great team at the University Bookshop. Well, last year I had the great pleasure in catching up with Dunedin writer Lawrence Fernley to talk about her novel that was coming out then called Wintertime. Here is that chat. Lawrence Fernley is an award-winning novelist and essayist who lives in Dunedin, and I've had the pleasure of chatting with Lawrence a number of times over the years about her books, and today we celebrate her recent novel, Wintertime. Lawrence, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Vanda.
Now, I'm going to read the cover, back cover blurb of the book first, just to give our audience out there a little taste of what Wintertime is about. The SUV advanced without slowing it past. The driver probably didn't even register him. Roland watched until it reached the canal crossing, where the curve of the hill and the trees swallowed it up. And then he was alone with his frosted breathing, the mist, another breath, a sob. Having returned to the Mackenzie country to deal with the unexpected death of his brother, Roland has had more than enough on his plate. He could do without the demands of a cantankerous neighbour, the complaints of his partner back in Australia, and discovering that someone is impersonating him online, stirring up the locals against him. Even the weather is hostile, rendering roads unpassable, and his old home an icebox, the fire offering little comfort. And yet, when cycling on the empty roads, cocooned in a snow-muffled landscape, he finds he can confront what he actually feels. So now, your previous novels have had this kind of like that underlying theme of something around the senses. You know, last time I think we talked about Scented, which was about a sense of smell. Does Wintertime follow the same kind of exploration?
So Wintertime was based on touch. It started off really, like a lot of my novels, they don't start off with a plot or a character. It starts off with an image I have in my head. And with Scented, it was a person's loft studio where they lived that was based in an old wool store. So it had that smell of wool in the wood. And Wintertime came after my mother died, and I was thinking about her a lot in the early holidays we used to have around Tekapo. And I was thinking about that sort of crusty snow, you know, when you stand on it and it's got a really sort of hard crust and you fall through and it's kind of quite sharp on your ankles. But when you look into the hole, there's that beautiful blue colour from the snow and ice. So the whole novel was just really built up around that one image of a footprint in the snow. And touch, so touch is working in terms of temperature, you know, the feeling of cold, but also touch the way people relate to one another and family, mostly family relationships, you know, those very important sort of relationships.
Listeners will probably be quite amazed that to think that you can build an entire novel based on just that one mental image.
Yeah, well, it's funny. I think that's really how I've always built up novels. I remember writing Edwin and Matilda, which was set in the Maniototo, and just building that up from this image I had of a pair of corduroy trousers, that sort of soft brown trousers, and then from there thinking of the person who wore them, and then tussocks, you know, warm tussocks blowing in the wind and that sort of type of thing. So that's probably how I always come to a novel, and it probably explains a lot about why my plots aren't necessarily as well developed as a lot of plot-driven novelists. You know, a lot of my novels are more sensory and more descriptive and tend to sort of quite slow-moving, and they don't have that kind of really tight plot with a big resolved ending. They're kind of a bit more open than that.
Mm. And coming back to that idea of, you know, working on a theme of the senses, do you like that as a mental challenge when doing a novel, thinking, okay, I'm going to approach it from this side?
Yeah, I do. I thought that it might be a bit gimmicky, but it's been a really interesting process because it sort of makes you think about how sentences are constructed and things. So with touch, not only that sense of people touching and the temperature, but trying to make the writing very textured and trying to build up sort of textures within the writing. And at the moment, I'm writing a novel that's based on the sound component. And so thinking very much about the rhythm of language and cadences of language and words and how words play off one another. So it's kind of interesting on all different levels for me as the writer, because not only are you writing the plot and the character and the locations, but also you're looking at the language itself. So it's a really interesting puzzle, and I'm really enjoying it.
Now that, having read Winter Time, I'm going to have to go and have, now that you've mentioned about, you know, the physical presence on the page, I'm going to have a little flick through and look at that and explore that.
See, there's probably quite a lot of clauses that sort of build up, you know, and layer upon it, one on top of another, so that you get these different layers and that kind of thing. So the sentences aren't very clipped. They're kind of a little bit rambly and layered, and I think that's what I was trying to go for. And also that kind of layering and those long clauses sort of lends itself to a bit of forward motion as well, which is quite nice, which kind of relates to the kind of the wheels turning, because he goes everywhere by bicycle. Mm. So it's that same kind of rhythm as biking and that wheel turning kind of thing, but slipping because he bikes in the snow, so the wheels are slipping and stuff like that.
And in a lovely kind of way, that also ties into Roland's own thought patterns with all the stuff that's going on, because, you know, that's kind of a bit up and down and
a lot of and a lot of internal sort of, you know, there's not much in terms of him talking. You know, he's away from his partner who's in Sydney, and I wanted the contrast of the really wet Sydney with the really cold Mackenzie. He's sort of separated from his partner a lot of the time in the book, and so is communicating through telephone. So that's another kind of touch thing, you know. And when he's with his partner, they're going through a real cold patch. So there's that kind of side to it as well. And also being finding that, you know, he's really the last member of his family alive, and that sense of feeling like an orphan, which is sort of, you know, even as you're an adult, when my mum died just before I started the novel, even though I was, you know, 56 or 57 or whatever, you suddenly have an awareness that you're kind of orphaned, and the people that know you and have the family history are suddenly not there. So that sort of thing as well.
Because, yeah, that is a quite an awakening to have, having experienced that myself.
Yeah.
Now, your title, Wintertime, and this ties in beautifully to what you've just said, is, you know, very apt, because it's that season physically that Roland finds himself in, but also metaphysically.
Yeah.
So, you know, how much did that subject of grief play into your setting?
Oh, I think a lot. I think, the whole book was a way to work through the grief I was feeling when my mother died. You know, I really wrote it as a response to that image and thinking about those winter holidays. And so working through that grief of my mother, and that was really how the book came about in a way. But then halfway through the book, sort of almost literally halfway through the book, I became very sick with cancer, and so the book was put on hold for a year. So it sort of started out to work through the grief of losing my mother, and it's kind of ended up as a way to distract me once I started getting well enough to write again, because it was about a year when I was just too sick to write, to not only finish the project, because I don't like things hanging over me at all. They kind of really niggle away. But as a way of writing healing me. So that was really important too.
And did you find then, you know, working your way back and finding your stride again after cancer, that tied into Roland's development as a character through that latter half of the book?
It's really interesting. It's kind of funny, because in the time that I wasn't writing, I was basically just lying on the couch or in bed, you know, daydreaming and sleeping. And so a bit like when you write a short story, you tend, because it's, you know, a shorter piece of fiction, when I do a short story, I tend to sort of work it all out in my head before I start writing. And so the latter half of this book, I was kind of working out and almost writing in my head before I started getting back into writing it out on the computer again. And so although I wasn't making notes or writing in a notebook like I often do, I was able to kind of work out different plot developments and things like that whilst I was sick. So when I did get back into writing, it was almost like I knew the direction the book was going to go in, which is something that is really unusual for me because, you know, I've just finished the first draft of this other novel and, you know, the end always comes as a complete surprise to me because I never knew it was there. You know, I'd never know from one day to the next what's going to happen. I'm totally led by, you know, the headlights, seeing as far as the headlights. Yeah.
Before we all came in to talk in studio, we were having a chat on the sofa about how your characters get under your skin and they can, like, push you along. So did you find that, you know, Roland in his own way actually was helping you in your recovery?
Oh, for sure. I mean, one of the things when I was really sick, you know, and in hospital as well, I was thinking, right, well, this is, you know, traditionally the time when you have a bit of an epiphany and you, you know, find God or whatever. And the only epiphany I had was I decided that writing actually was really important to me. And by writing, I don't mean publishing and reviews and funding and, you know, that kind of stuff, but just the physical act of writing and putting down stories. And I think it's true, that thing, you know, a lot of people write to find out the things that are bugging them, or they write to understand their own lives. And I think that came with Wintertime. Yeah.
Now, the novel is set in the Mackenzie country in a town called Matariki, which is fairly recognisable as another pre-existing town. So why?
Yes. I had to change it because at the opening of the book, the character Eddie drives into a canal and drowns. And so originally it was going to be set in Tekapo, and then when I first started, which was back in 2019, you know, I just assumed the canal roads were still open. And, of course, they're not open to the public anymore. They've been closed for a couple of years, and I hadn't realised that. And I thought, well, if I have them driving into the canal, that's going to, you know, create a bit of a problem. And also I wanted to have a house by a certain architect called Humphrey Hall in the town, and there is no house by that architect in the town. And also, you know, just little things, you know, like if I had a shop and the shop wasn't there. So I thought I'll change the name and then I can kind of put in what I want, really, and it doesn't matter if the shop's in the wrong place or the cafe's open at 7 when it wouldn't be open till 10, you know.
Because you know your readers would pick you up on it.
I sure do.
Get those emails.
Oh, yeah, the hut builder taught me a good lesson about that. So, yeah.
So you'll be going, phew, that you checked on the canals.
Yeah, phew that I checked on the canals. And yeah, and all those sorts of things.
Now, one of the fabulous elements in this novel is your description of the elements and the cold. I mean, it literally sort of, you know, gave me the goosey bumps and made me shiver. So what did you draw upon for that?
A lot of it was from my memories of being a little kid. So when I was a little kid, we lived in Fairlie, but even after we moved to Christchurch, we used to come back to the sort of Mackenzie and Araki and camp. And my memories of camping, for some reason, are always of winter when, you know, you'd go to bed when it got dark and you'd wake up and you'd think, oh, God, you know, how much longer till daybreak? And, you know, it would only be 9 o'clock at night or something, you know. You know, the inside of the tent would freeze and you'd have that frost on the tent and all those sorts of things, and your feet would be so cold that they'd sort of go hard, and then, you know, as they were thawing out, you get – and also, like, you remember how cold you used to get biking to school and things like that, you know, having really cold feet, and also in Christchurch, you know, being cold as well. So I just wanted to draw on all that side of it, but also the beauty of it. You know, those hoar frosts when you get the ice on the fence lines or the, you know, and the sun comes out and everything glitters, and, you know, I love that. But also that sort of disorientating feeling when you're in a kind of a whiteout and you can't see the horizon and you can't really tell whether you're walking on snow or sky and that kind of thing. So just drawing on those experiences. And also when I was little, I learned to ski. I used to have a little pair of wooden skis, and it was when you used to have to walk up pretty much to a lot of the ski fields around that area because they didn't have the roads put in properly. I just remember how cold that was as well, just miserably cold because my ski boots were just really gum boots with laces and
two pairs of socks.
It was so cold. Yeah.
Now, one of the amazing things that you have done in your life was being in that Artists to Antarctica Fellowship in 2004. So, you know, I was naturally sort of wondering, were memories of that also intertwined?
Well, that was surprisingly warm by comparison, because the thing about being in the Antarctic in summer is that the sun's always shining. So when you're in your tent, it's nice and it's really cozy, like 25 degrees or something, because the sun's beating down on it all day. Whereas in the Mackenzie in winter, you know, the sun's sort of gone and you've been in the shade. And, you know, it's a classic thing when you're camping and you can see the sun on the hills in the distance, but everything around you is completely frosted and just frozen. And it seems to take about 3 hours for the sun to slowly creep across the plains to get to you. Yeah.
And that was one of the wonderful things I enjoyed about reading this book was, you know, you got that sense in that whiteout one, especially when he was out on his bike in mad conditions.
Yeah.
I wanted to tell him, no, Roland, don't go out in that.
Yeah, get a driver's license. Yeah. So, yeah, I haven't biked in a proper whiteout, but I have biked in really cold conditions and it's pretty miserable.
Yeah. Now, relationships do hold a large space in this novel. Now, as you mentioned earlier, he's got a relationship with his siblings and his parents, and his partner in Australia, his neighbour, and newfound friends that he makes when he returns to Matariki. So how did you approach the complexities of these?
I think I was just really led by the characters. One of the things that also started this story was that I sometimes write comments on this perfume blog that I follow. And at one point somebody replied to one of my comments and said, hey, I'm really enjoying your Instagram account and what you've been writing in your blog. And I thought, well, that's really odd because I don't have a blog or an Instagram.
Really?
Yeah. Okay. And so I thought, oh, I wonder if someone's impersonating me, you know, or just lifting the stuff that I write on this perfume site, you know, and creating something. And I had, you know, I'm not on Facebook or any of that kind of stuff because a lot of this novel's to do with his identity sort of being targeted. And I thought, how on earth would I go about checking on that kind of stuff or removing it? And I just found it completely so complicated. I thought, oh, I just can't be bothered, you know, for myself personally. And then I thought, well, knowing him, he probably couldn't be bothered either. But, you know, his whole life gets really kind of messed up by this person who's kind of, or persons, I mean, how would you know all these comments, where they're coming from, sort of making these attacks on the community when his brother dies, because his brother's is a tar. He shoots tar, and there's been quite a lot of controversy about, you know, culling tar in that sort of area, whether some should be left for hunters or, you know, whether they're a menace and a pest. So it was sort of drawing on all that sort of political stuff as well. But, yeah.
Which is interesting because, you know, there is, despite your saying that you sometimes feel that your novels are a bit meandery and things like that, but I found that there was a lot of tension.
Yeah.
In this novel, and part of that was around the issues of someone stirring up doubt and this impersonating him. So how did you actually purposefully build the tension, or did that kind of come organically?
I sort of built it. And also, I mean, I just read Margie Thompson's great book on whale oil, which was a real this fantastic book for anyone who hasn't read it. But also when I was sick, I started reading – I always read Australian fiction. I read – I would say probably 80% of my reading is Australian fiction. I just really love it because of the sense of place and also the point of view that a lot of Australian fiction has. And when I was sick, I also started reading a lot of thrillers, which isn't what I normally read, but I found them that I could follow them without, you know, I like the story. So I was reading people like Jane Harper and Gary Disher and Chris Hammer and Peter Temple, all those kind
some
of...
Some fantastic Australian writers.
Yeah, really good Australian writers, really, really good, and really good at plot and good at character and not too stereotyped. And they don't always do that thing that I don't like is when I've read quite a lot of Scottish thrillers as well, you know, where every chapter ends with, you know, a phone call or a note left on a car windscreen, or, you know, and you sort of know that that's going to propel you. But anyway, so they're quite subtle. And so I was kind of studying how to build up tension as well as I was reading. So that was quite an interesting thing to do too.
So, you know, with the tension and the characterization, do you find after the fact that the characters in your books stay with you, or are you able to, once you'd finished with Roland, sort of pop him aside and then move on to the next project? How much mental overlap do you find in your novels?
I think what happens with me is I kind of feel very close to the characters. And what's happened in my case is I tend to, it's almost like I've populated the bottom half of the South Island with characters. So wherever I go, you know, if I go through the, you know, through Ranfurly and Waipiata, I sort of see Edwin and Matilda. And if I go down to Invercargill, I see Maggie from Mother's Day. And if I go through towards Te Anau, I see Warwick and Dean from Butler's Ringlet and the Mackenzie, you know. So I kind of see these people almost like ghosts and spirits still there afterwards. But I don't sort of, it's kind of, I get a sense of closure, I think, when I write the last page. And it often makes me quite sad, you know, like it can be quite sort of not overwhelming, but quite a sort of sense of loss or grief when you finish a book, I think, because it's been such a big part of your life and they've seen you through. And then it's kind of like you're shutting the door on them. You're not killing them. It's not like you're putting down a favorite dog, but it's kind of like you're putting them back on the shelf, almost literally, I guess, and you miss them. Yeah, you miss them.
Well, that's great. Thank you so much, Lawrence.
Thanks,
it's been an absolute pleasure again talking about Wintertime, and very much look forward to your next work.
Yeah,
not putting pressure on for you to get that completed.
Yeah, that's set in the West Coast in a place that isn't Franz Josef.
Wink, wink.
Yeah.
No, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks, Vanda.
Well, that is our show for this month. Thank you so much for listening in. And thank you to my guests, Lawrence Fernley, talking about her novel Wintertime, and Paul Sorrell, talking about getting closer, rediscovering nature through bird photography. Join us again next month for another hour delving into the wonderful world of books. But until then, enjoy lots of great reading. What do you want to be when you grow up? They say you are what you read, and the University Bookshop can help you be whoever you want to be. Do you want to be an athlete? Then sit down with an inspiring sports biography. Do you fancy yourself as a detective? We have a grisly lineup of murder mysteries waiting just for you. Do you aspire to be the world's greatest chef? We have cookbooks to tantalize your taste buds. Do you want to celebrate your inner child? Play up in our fabulous children's room. The University Bookshop, helping you decide what you want to be when you grow up.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.